after the destruction of the first temple, the majority of Jews, the vast majority of Jews from Yehuda and Yerushalayim were taken into exile into Bavel. However, not all of them were taken. And a number of events occurred which would be a harbinger of what was to come in the time of the Second Temple. And it would not be a pleasant harbinger. It would not express good news for the future of the Jewish people, because we will see that even in the midst of the terrible destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and in the time when everything was going under and one would think that the Jewish people would have learned their lesson, we'll see that a segment of the Jewish people not only did not learn the lesson, but became infected with the disease of machlokas and sinas chinam, of being divisive, mounting a rebellion, a civil war, assassination, violence, all in a less than noble cause, and that this eventually undid any positive element that could have stemmed from the lessons of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We commemorate these events by the famous fast day of Tzom Gedalia, the fast day which is named after Gedalia, Gedalia ben Achikam, who is one of the participants in this drama. And we celebrate this, we commemorate this fast day on the third day of Tishrei, the day after Rosh Hashanah, after the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. And as I'll mention to you a little later on, this commemoration is not only coincidental with the dates that it happened, but is also representative of the problems that Rosh Hashanah and the Yom Meroyim and Yom HaKippurim attempt to deal with and attempt to improve us, to improve our behavior. When the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the prophet Yirmiyahu was in jail. He was still in the dungeon in the Chatzer HaMatara, and he was held there as a political prisoner of the king of Judah, Tzidkiyahu, and he had been imprisoned a number of times, the Navi Yirmiyahu, in his long and stormy career. And now, as all of his awful predictions regarding what would happen to the Jewish people in Yerushalayim came to fruition, when everyone saw that his words were not hyperbole or exaggeration, but that in fact the worst happened, and it happened in a fashion far more drastic than they ever imagined, he himself is a prisoner in the dungeon. Now, the greatness of the Navi Yirmiyahu flows from many, many different aspects of his character. But one aspect of his character which should be noted here is the fact that the Navi Yirmiyahu was a person who felt deeply the tragedy of his people and did not bask in saying, "I told you so," or "You guys had it coming," or "You deserved it, and therefore, you know, tough on you." Others would even rejoice that their prophecy of doom came true, because then they would have been personally vindicated at the expense of all of those who mocked and punished them. But that was not the behavior of the Navi Yirmiyahu under any circumstance. And he himself, when he heard the terrible news of the destruction of the temple, rent his garments, placed ashes and sackcloth upon himself, and he tied himself in chains. He had chains put in on his arms so that he was manacled just as the other Jewish prisoners who were about to be led away to Bavel, led away to Babylonia, he also was going with them. And he did not pull rank to say, you know, well, I'm the Novi. He didn't go to the Babylonian commander and say, you know, "I was on your side all the time." But rather he, to the end, was the loyal and ever faithful, trustworthy member of the Jewish people. I cannot emphasize that enough, because unfortunately in all of the tragedies that have befallen Israel from the time of the first Churban Beis HaMikdash till today, that type of behavior has not always occurred. And many doomsayers could not resist the temptation of saying, I told you so. And that it's because of your sins that you're being destroyed, and you didn't listen to me, and therefore, good that it happened to you. That's not Yirmiyahu. That's part of the greatness of the Navi. The Navi, however, was the beneficiary of, naturally, of God's beneficence, but he's also the beneficiary. God has it done through the Babylonian emperor Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was aware that during all of the time when the Jewish people were planning the rebellion against him, that Yirmiyahu opposed the rebellion. Yirmiyahu said that the Jewish people should accept the yoke of Bavel and that they should not mount any attacks upon the Babylonians and that it was futile to resist. For that, he was called a negativist, and he was a defeatist, and he was put into jail by Tzidkiyahu, who wanted to mount the attack. Nebuchadnezzar ascribed to Yirmiyahu a collaborationist type of behavior, and therefore he wanted to reward him, because he thought the Navi Yirmiyahu was doing it on behalf of Bavel somehow. He was a Bavelophobe. I like that for a word. He was a somebody that liked Bavel, right? He was, therefore, he was entitled to reward. The Navi Yirmiyahu had no love for Bavel at all, just the opposite. And he saw in it the evil that it was. But he had spoken as he did because he was the prophet delivering the message of God and hoping that somehow the Jewish people could change their course before the final disaster overtook them. The king, however, wanted to reward Yirmiyahu, so he gave a command to his general, to Nebuzaradan, who later would commit suicide and become Jewish. He became Jewish first, and that killed him. He gave command to Nebuzaradan to make certain that Yirmiyahu is not killed, and to make certain that he is taken out of the dungeon, and that he is treated with respect, and that whatever his needs are, physical needs, that they should be taken care of, his health, his food, and that he should be given the choice of wherever he wants to go, wherever he wants to live. And Nebuzaradan followed the instructions, and he sent a delegation, a high delegation of officers, to find the Navi, and they found them at the entrance to the dungeon, where he had been incarcerated during the entire period of time, and they saw the chains, the manacles on his hands, and they saw that he was in a procession of Jews that was being led away to begin their sad trek to Babylonia. He was removed from the line. His manacles were cut away from him. And he was brought in front of the Nebuzaradan. And Nebuzaradan gave him clothing, and he gave him food, and he attended to his needs, and he told him as follows. He said, if you want to come to Bavel with us, we're very happy that you should come with us. But you don't come in chains, you come as an exalted and honored guest. If you don't want to come to Bavel, then you can stay wherever you want. You can stay here in the country. Now, what had happened was that the Babylonians, for a number of reasons, political and military, decided that they would leave a remnant of the Jewish people in Eretz Israel, not in Yerushalayim, but in Eretz Israel. And that they would leave them there to help build up the country and to be loyal subjects of Bavel. You see, Nebuchadnezzar's fixation with the Jews, his attitude to the Jews, was that he wanted somehow that there should be a puppet government that should rule the Jews and he should benefit from them. And he wanted that Eretz Israel should remain under Jewish control. And therefore he appointed a man called Gedaliah ben Achikam, who was not from the royal house of David. He purposely chose someone that did not have royal blood, so he would have no pretensions. You wouldn't imagine that he's going to become the king. He didn't want a replay of the rebellion of Tzidkiyahu. And he chose him to be the governor general, so to speak, of the territory, the head of the remaining Jews who were in the land of Israel. And he left over what we would call the peasant class. He left over the lowest element socially, economically, and one could even say religiously. So that you had a strange phenomena that the higher element, the Talmidei Chachomim and the wealthy people and the princes of Israel and the royal household, they were all taken away to Bavel. And that's why the Babylonian Jewish community flourished and achieved the distinction that it did throughout its history was because of the fact that it had good stock. And we'll find the same thing, an interesting comparison, that when Ezra later returned from Bavel to Eretz Israel, he did the same thing. He left the best in Bavel. It says, Asora Yuchsin Olu Mibavel Eretz Israel. So the Mishnah lists for us that the Mamzerim came, Shtukim came, Asufim came, Avodim came, not the highest class of people. All the questionable yichis, all the guys that one was in doubt as to their legitimacy came. It says, Lo'ola Ezra mibovel acheoso bovel kesolis nekia. Ezra did not go up from Bavel until he made sure that in Bavel everybody that remained was a good, perfect Jew. So again, you have the same thing. That in Bavel, a very high and exalted and intelligent and sophisticated element remained. And they're the ones that built Babylonian Jewry. While those that remained in Eretz Yisrael after the Churban, and those who came back later with Ezra and Nehemiah, were of lesser quality, so to speak. Now there's an idea here that I cannot put my finger on exactly, but there's an inkling of an idea that somehow Eretz Yisrael is always built by whoever builds it. And that as long as the Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael is buttressed by whatever Jews are there. Whereas in the Golis, the survival and the flowering of the exile, so to speak, is dependent upon having only the best, because otherwise it wouldn't make it. Bavel apparently could not have survived without having this upper echelon of Jew present, whereas Eretz Yisrael did very well even with having of the peasant class and later those of questionable yichus. In any event, Nebuzaradan left over this peasant class, farmers, small artisans, small businessmen, and they were under the rule of Gedaliah ben Achikam, whose headquarters, whose capital was in Mitzpah, where Shmuel met in Mitzpah. which is north of Yerushalayim and also somewhat east of Yerushalayim, and that's where they were located. Yirmiyahu is in doubt. He doesn't know what to do. Part of him pulls him to go to Bovel. There in Bovel, the Novi Yecheskel is there. His disciples are there. The upper element of the Jewish people with whom he had such affinity, they were all there. On the other hand, he did not want to leave Eretz Yisrael. And especially did not want to leave Eretz Yisrael at this time when the Jewish presence in the country was so tenuous. And therefore, he delayed and he went to the house, he went to the court, rather, of Gedaliah ben Achiko. And he arrived there for Rosh Hashanah in Mitzpah. So the Churban Beis HaMikdash took place, as we discussed, the 9th and 10th of Av. About almost 2 months later, 7 weeks later, is when Gedaliah ben Achikam and the remnants of the Jews were ensconced here in Mitzpah. And they there had their rudimentary government, even though they were under the supervision of the Babylonians, but they had some sort of autonomy. And the Novi Yirmiyahu came to join them. The Novi Yirmiyahu came to meet them and to join them there. And he came for Rosh Hashanah. We also see that freed with the Novi Yirmiyahu was his disciple Baruch ben Neriah. Baruch ben Neriah was the scribe, the disciple of the Novi Yirmiyahu. Much of the book of Yirmiyahu he transcribed and wrote. Much of Megillas Eicha he transcribed and wrote. And eventually he was also the teacher of the great Ezra. So he's the conduit for the Torah Shebaal Peh. He's the conduit for the tradition of the Jewish people. So Baruch and Yirmiyahu arrive to spend Rosh Hashanah with Gedaliah ben Achiko. Now the plot thickens. The king of Bnei Ammon, which was Transjordan, right? The King Hussein of his day, a man by the name of Abbasis, objected to the fact that there would still be a Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael. He objected to it for two reasons. One reason was that he hated the Jewish people and he wanted them destroyed completely. The second reason was that he wanted to annex part of it to the kingdom of Bnei Ammon. And he thought that if the Jewish people were not there, he would be able to strike a much better deal with Bovel and be able to annex part of the West Bank to the East Bank. All of history sounds familiar to us. The names of the characters change, but the basic outlines of the scheme are the same. When he heard that Nebuzaradan appointed Gedaliah ben Achikam to be the governor general of Eretz Yisrael, and that a substantial number of Jews, even though they were peasants, but a substantial number of Jews remained and would have the right to till the earth and would have the right to have a society, to have a country, to have a government. So he was mightily upset because he said now he won't be able to make this arrangement because the Jews will protest any annexation. And if the Babylonian king agreed to Gedaliah ben Achikam, it must be that the Babylonian king also wants that the Jews should be there. And he felt that it was not in the interests of Bnei Ammon, not at all, that there be a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. He therefore proposed to destroy the Jewish presence. How would you destroy the Jewish presence? By assassinating Gedaliah ben Achikam, who was an officer of Bavel, by getting a Jew to assassinate Gedaliah ben Achikam, and then being able to lay the blame on the rest of the Jewish people for having done so, thereby being able to tell Nebuchadnezzar, look, the Jewish people are willing to rebel against you once more because of the fact that, what, that look, they have assassinated your own hand-picked, chosen leader. They have killed him, and therefore the only way to handle the Jewish people is get them all out of here or kill them all out. Let's get rid of him. But your soft approach, so to speak, that you are allowing them to stay in the land of Israel and you're allowing them to have a leader and a government, that will only lead to disaster. That was the plan of Bosses. In order that this plan should work, he had to have a Jew that would be willing to do it for him. And he got a Jew of substance, a well-known Jew. He didn't pick up stam a guy off the street. And the man's name was Yishmoel ben Netanyo. Now Yishmoel ben Netanyo was a member of the royal household. He was a member, he was descended from the house of David. So he naturally, personally, was very upset that Gedaliah ben Achikam was appointed, thereby circumventing the dynasty of the house of David. We'll see that throughout the second Beis HaMikdash, there was a tension between the descendants of Dovid HaMelech and the people who actually served as being the leaders of the Jewish government, whether it be the Hashmonaim, who were from the Kohanim, or whether it be the other leaders of the Jewish people who were not from the house of David. And the royal family felt that not only was it slighted, but that it was morally, halachically wrong for anybody else to head the Jewish people. It doesn't make any difference that for the whole period, over 400 years, at no time was any member of the house of David considered to be the leader of the Jewish people, perhaps with the exception of Zerubbabel at the onset, who was descended from Tzidkio, from Yoyachin, from that family, from the house of David. So Yishmoel had a personal axe to grind, and his personal axe was his jealousy that he was passed over for the spot and that it was given to Gedaliah. So the king of Bnei Ammon made him an offer that he not only could not, he did not refuse. He told him, take a group of men and assassinate him. And then when all of this blows over, all of this terrible events, and Bavel will come and expel the Jewish people, etc., you'll be paid, I'll pay you a great deal of money and a great deal of honor, and if there's ever a Jewish kingdom, an autonomous Jewish kingdom established again there, you'll be the head of it. I'll see to it that you'll be the head of it. Now this pie-in-the-sky plan nevertheless convinced Yishmoel ben Netanyahu. Why? Because he wanted to kill Gedaliah, right? When you want to do it, so it doesn't make any difference that all the reasons are lousy. You just want to do it. Anybody who has been, who has counseled people in business or in law or in accounting knows that sometimes you have a client that he just wants to do it, and all of your good advice will not swerve him whatsoever. It will not change him. You can tell him, don't buy the building, we can't get clear title, you're paying too much, you can't get a mortgage. He wants to buy that building. He wants to buy the building, he's going to buy it. And all of your good, the only thing that you may succeed is that he'll have another lawyer handle the closing for him. But you're never going to talk them out of it. It doesn't need logic. And here also, Bosses did not have a hard job selling this plan to Yishmael. Yishmael was willing to do it without any hesitation. It's interesting, by the way, that we find the name Yishmael here as the name of a Jew. We find later in the time of the Talmud, Tanoim were named Yishmael as well. But one could say from the time of Muhammad onwards, Yishmael is no longer a Jewish name. Now, he came to spend Rosh Hashanah with the with Gedaliah. From the Tanakh, from the Psukim in the Tanakh, it can readily be inferred that this assassination took place on Rosh Hashanah itself, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, which would only compound the hideous felony that he came to the Rosh Hashanah meal, and he, because he came to the Rosh Hashanah meal, he was invited, and there the assassination took place. The Tanakh tells us, interestingly enough, that Gedaliah ben Achikam had a palace guard under a man called Yochanan ben Kereach, and they had a good system of intelligence. And they came to him and they told him, this is going to happen. Yishmael ben Netanyahu has made a deal with the king of Bnei Ammon to assassinate you. So, watch yourself. But they don't, not only said, watch yourself, they said, let us bump him off first. What today we call a preemptive attack, preemptive strike. Why should we sit here and wait for him to come? He's going to kill you. And not only kill you, if you don't care about yourself, but he's going to undo any chance we have here. So let us kill him. Based the Talmudic axiom, Habo lahorgo hashkem vehorgeyu. He who comes to kill you, hashkem, you get up earlier, vehorgeyu, and kill him. Preemptive self-defense is legitimate in halacha. Many times in life it's necessary, certainly in the national life. We've had examples of it in our time. The Six-Day War was probably the prime example. You just can't wait to be destroyed. And therefore, they knew that he was coming on this terrible mission, this mission of murder. So they said to Gedaliah, don't sit back. Let us take care of him for you. Now, Gedaliah, we don't know that much about him. But what we see in Tanakh is that he had one of these magnanimous, friendly, trusting, almost naive personalities, which is a great guy to have for a shul president, but it's not going to cut the mustard here in this terrible situation. And Gedaliah said, oh no, he said, what, Yishmael, he's an old friend of mine, we know each other, you know, we went to the yeshiva together, there's no problems with him, what kind of nonsense, he's coming to assassinate me. Don't you dare kill him, don't you dare touch him. And not only that, when he came, he invited him in and he sat him at the head table and they had Rosh Hashanah meal together. What could be better? And he did kill him. He assassinated him. He had 10 men with him. He not only assassinated Gedaliah ben Achikam, he also killed out his palace guard, and he also killed many of the Babylonian soldiers who were part of the governmental structure, let us say, that Gedaliah ben Achikam had going for him. And this happened, as I mentioned, on the on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. That's what it says in the Tanakh. It's mashma the Tanakh. It says Vayi Bachodesh Ashvi. It was in the seventh month. Usually, when it says Bachodesh Ashvi, it means on Rosh Chodesh. So the Rosh Chodesh of the seventh month is Rosh Hashanah. Bo Yishmoel ben Netanya ben Elishama Mizera Melucha. So Yishmoel ben Netanya ben Elishama, who was from the seed of David, and he came with 10 men with him, El Gedalia ben Achikam Amitzposo, to Mitzpah, to Gedalia ben Achikam, Vayochlu Shom Lechem Yachdo ba Mitzpah, and they ate together. In the middle of the meal, Vayokom Yishmoel ben Netanyo, Vaseres Anoshim Asher Oyo Yito, Vayaku Ez Gedalia ben Achikam ben Shofen Bacher Vayomes Oso. They hit him by the sword, but he was a tough guy, Gedalia, in spite of everything. So the blows that were rained upon him were not enough to kill him. So Yishmoel killed him with his bare hands. That's the way the tradition that we have from the rabbis. Vayomes Oso, he killed him. And everybody else that was around, they killed. They destroyed. Now, Balis thought, again, that this would play perfectly into what he wanted to happen. This man, Yishmoel, he had an engaging personality. We see that he was able to take in Gedalia ben Achikam. He was also able, we'll see in a moment, he was able to convince other people. He was a good actor. And they were able to... It's not clear how he did it. He did it by surprise, because the number of defenders that Gedalia had far outnumbered Yishmoel and his 10 men. But they were able to do it by surprise, and they died. Then the Tanakh tells us, Vayi Bayom Asheni Lahomi says Gedalia, the next day. So the first day of Bayom Asheni is the second day of Tishrei, meaning the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Now the Yerushalmi tells us, the Yerushalmi tells us that from the time of Shmuel Hanavi, Rosh Hashanah was already 2 days. So this was the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So people came from Shechem, from Shiloh, and from Shomron. 80 men came. And they came in clothing of mourning. Imagine the first Rosh Hashanah without the Beis HaMikdash. The first Rosh Hashanah, I mean, they had the Mishkan all the years, and then they had the Beis HaMikdash. Almost 1,000 years. And this is the first time without the Beis HaMikdash. So they came as mourners to come to on the way to Yerushalayim. So they stopped at Mitzpah, where Gedalia was. And they brought with them an offering that they wanted to put on the place where the Beis HaMikdash had stood. Yishmoel went out to greet them, and he also went out in clothing of mourning. He wanted to show them that he also missed the Beis HaMikdash. And he said, listen, don't pass by here. Come spend the second day of Yontav with us. Come, Gedalia invites you in. Gedalia is dead already. Gedalia invites you in. And when they came into the city, he slaughtered 70 of them. And 10 of them were saved because the 10 bribed him. The 10 said to him that they had hidden treasures in the fields, and they would give him away the treasures. So temporarily he kept them alive, and the other 70 he slaughtered. And he said that he was slaughtering them under the orders of Gedalia. And that was meant to retroactively justify his assassination of Gedaliah. Could you see what kind of guy Gedaliah was? Gedaliah was such a traitor to the Jewish cause. He was such a puppet of the Babylonians that he was willing to kill innocent Jews who were going to Yerushalayim in order to prevent them from going to Yerushalayim and stirring up a rebellion against Bovil. So he killed them. And he threw them into a pit. The pit was created, the Tanakh describes, by the king Osa of Yehuda, because of because of Baasha, the king of Israel. What happened was, Chazal say, you see how an Aveira is an Aveira is an Aveira is an Aveira. Because he had erected this pit, it was part of the fortifications of a wall system that was erected between Yehuda and Yisrael to prevent the Jews from Yisrael from coming to Yehuda to celebrate the holidays. So both sides agreed on this miserable plan. So eventually God saw to it that pit was full of innocent Jewish bodies. The price was extracted for it, even though it's hundreds of years later. But the Rabboni Shel Olam's cheshbon, the Rabboni Shel Olam's timetable is not ours. And therefore, since he has time, so he could wait until it happened. Then Yishmael took as hostages, it's mamish today's world, he took as hostages all the remaining Jews that were there in Mitzpah, who were there for the Yontif. And he was going to transport them. They were going to be the guarantee that he was going to be able to escape now to Bnei Amon. He would escape to Bnei Amon, and there he would wait until the Jewish community was destroyed. When the Jewish community was destroyed, then the king of Bnei Amon would be able to strike a deal with Bovel to annex the property, to annex the territory, and he would benefit thereby. Yochanan ben Koreach, who was the head of the army, heard, he was, as I mentioned to you before, he was originally already very suspicious of Yishmael, and he had warned Gedaliah not to let him into the palace, and Gedaliah, to his detriment, did not hearken. So he now found out the story. He found out that Gedaliah was assassinated, and he found out that Yishmael had killed the other 70 people. It's interesting, our rabbis comment that the Loshon in the Tanakh is as kol pigrei ha'anoshim asher hiko biyad Gedaliah, that Yishmael killed these 70 men biyad Gedaliah, through the hands of Gedaliah, as though Gedaliah ordered them. So the rabbis asked the question, what are you talking about, Gedaliah the Gemara Nida? The rabbis never, Gedaliah never ordered their death, Adarabba, Gedaliah wouldn't have heard a flea. So the rabbis answered, that was the problem. They died because of Gedaliah. And therefore the Tanakh called their murder on Gedaliah. So the judgment of Tanakh, the judgment of history is that the blood of those 70 people, even though they were murdered by Yishmael, part of the blame is Gedaliah. Because Gedaliah had advance information that the man was coming to assassinate him, and his misguided goodness, his misguided piety, look what happened. Look at the destruction that came forth from it. The Talmud tells us that also regarding the Churban of the second Beis Hamikdash, that there was a certain great Tana, Reb Zecharia, and that he was so modest that he refused to decide a matter of halacha that could have saved the Jewish people, that could have stopped the whole chain of events that eventually led the Romans and the Jews to have the war that destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. So it says, Anvasanuso, the modesty of Rabbi Zecharia, Hechri Beis Mikdashenu, destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. His modesty destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. Titus destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. The Romans destroyed it. But Chazal always saw not the direct cause, but the ultimate cause. And the ultimate cause many times lies in the behavior or lack of behavior of very good people. It lies in good things and not necessarily in evil intent or evil acts. And that's part of the tragedy here. This event is commemorated throughout forever in Jewish history by the fast of the third day of Tishrei called Tzom Gedalia. Now there's an opinion in the Talmud that his assassination took place on the third day, even though from the Tanakh it's not mashma that way. From the Tanakh it's, as I mentioned to you, it's pretty apparent that it happened on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and therefore the fast would be on the third day simply because we don't fast on Rosh Hashanah. However, there is opinion in the Talmud that it happened on the third day, so that the fast of Gedalia does fall on the exact Yortzeit, so to speak. It does fall on the exact day where it happened. The rabbis also comment we have a difference of opinion in halacha, whether one is allowed to fast on Rosh Hashanah or not, because Rosh Hashanah is a day of contemplation and of judgment. So on those days, a person may not have an appetite. So is he allowed to fast? So there are opinions in the Gaonim that it is a fast day. And then there are strong opinions that it's not a fast day, and not only is it not a fast day, it's not allowed to be a fast day. From that, we have the origin of the custom among certain people to make Kiddush before Tkiyas on Rosh Hashanah, etc. But part of the reason of those who said that it was a fast day, because it's a commemoration of what happened to Gedalia on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, what happened on Rosh Hashanah itself. That on Rosh Hashanah it really marks the end of the Jew. If Tisha B'Av is the destruction of the temple, Rosh Hashanah is the end of the Jewish presence, at least the first time around in Eretz Israel. Anyway, Yochanan ben Koreach organized an army, and he hot-footed it. He pursued Yishmael. He knew that he was trying to get across to Bnei Amon. He pursued him, and he was able to head him off at the pass, so to speak. And he, when the people, the hostages, saw that Yochanan ben Koreach and his men had overtaken Yishmael, they escaped from Yishmael. They escaped and came back to the side of Yochanan ben Koreach. And Yochanan ben Koreach was able to kill a number of the men of Yishmael, but he never caught Yishmael. Yishmael escaped. He went to Bnei Amon, and that's where he died. His dream never was realized. And he remains as one of the villains of Jewish history because of this base and murderous act that he committed. Now, it says in Tanakh that 8 of his men escaped with him. He came with 10, 8 escaped. So perhaps 8 reached Balis. So maybe 2 of them were killed or overcome in the pursuit. Now the Jewish people were in a quandary. What should they do? They were very frightened. They were frightened of the reactions of the Babylonians. What Nebuchadnezzar would do when he heard the news that his hand-picked governor had been assassinated by Jews. So they didn't know what to do. So they went to ask the Navi. Now we have two different viewpoints of how they asked. They went to ask the Navi what to do. they presented two scenarios to the Navi. One scenario was that they should stay in Eretz Yisrael. They should remain in Eretz Yisrael. And explain to the king that it was only a handful of people that perpetrated that assassination. And that the intention of the Jewish people was to remain loyal. Their intention was not to rebel against him. And that the king should take all of that into consideration and not punish them and allow them to remain. That was one plan. The second plan was that they should abandon Eretz Yisrael and flee to Egypt, because they felt that in Egypt they would be free of the scourge of Bovel, because Egypt was the second strongest empire, and they felt that it was going to be impervious to Babylonian conquest. So they went and they asked the Navi, Yirmiyahu, what they should do. Now, there are many who say that they had already made up their mind and that they just wanted Yirmiyahu to say yes. Many times, especially a rabbi, many times in life people come to you and they ask you for advice, and you already sense darn well that they have made up their mind. They only want that you should confirm the decision that they have already made, because that will strengthen them and it will also shift the blame if something goes wrong to you. In such instances, the Rav is always very well advised either to tell them the opposite of what they want to hear or not to tell them anything. The Navi Yirmiyahu here delayed 10 days. The Aseres Yemei Tshuva, he delayed. He gave them no answer till after Yom Kippur. And then he gave them a strange answer. A strong answer, but a strange answer. They had come to him and they said to him, "Kechol adover asher yishlochacho Hashem alokecho eleinu kainat," whatever you tell us, right? It's up to you. And they said, and he knew these guys. He'd been talking to them for 50 years. They never listened until now. They said, "Im tov, im ro, good or bad, b'kol Hashem Elokeinu asher anu sholchim oscho anachnu sholchim oscho elov nishma. Whatever God tells you, we don't care. Yes or no, we'll do it." So Yirmiyahu answered them. He said, "Well, I got a message for God, from God. You remember, you sent me to him on your behalf, and you said that you were going to listen to whatever he said. So he says, stay here. Don't leave Eretz Yisrael. Stay here. And don't be afraid of the king of Bovel. King of Bovel won't harm you. And you should build houses and farm your land and make orchards and vineyards, and God will give you a saving remnant here, and eventually it'll all come right. Don't forsake Eretz Yisrael. Don't leave. Don't go to the Mitzrayim." And then he said to him, "But you have in mind that you do want to go, because you think that when you come to Mitzrayim, somehow you're going to be more secure, you're going to be safe, and Bovel won't be able to reach you. No problems." In the Second World War, I know somebody who in the Second World War in 1938 was able to leave Germany. So he had a choice of where to go, whether to go to France or to England. So he said he decided to go to France because France had the Maginot Line. And France had the largest standing army in Europe, and there was no question that France could not be defeated by Germany. Whereas if he went to England, he said, the Germans would bomb it, there would be all sorts of problems, and he didn't like the English, so he chose and he went to France, for which he was promptly captured again and spent years in camps until he survived and the war was over. Bad choice, right? But those bad choices are always made in hindsight. So here also, the Navi says, you're going to Mitzrayim to be safe. It's a little like the choice that Lot made, right? He went to Sodom because he didn't want to be bothered. He wanted to be safe, right? He didn't see that the safest place on earth was in Abraham's tent, and that the nuclear holocaust was waiting for him where he went. So that's exactly what Yirmiyahu told them. Don't go, stay, we'll build a country together. Don't leave Eretz Yisrael. Don't think that anything good is going to happen to you in Egypt. So they said to him, what a chutzpah! What do you mean stay? Sheker atom medaber. You're telling us lie. You hear the language, right? This is a board meeting. Sheker atom medaber. You're telling us lies. Lo shlochacha Hashem Elokeinu lemar lo savo Mitzrayim lo gershom. God never told you not to go, that we shouldn't go to Egypt. You're making it up. And then they said, your Talmud, Baruch ben Neriah, he's the guy that talked you into it. You know, because he's not on our side. Imagine. And they said, you're a collaborator. Lamanteso son of Biadakazdim, you want to give us over in the hands of the Chaldeans again, into the Babylonians. Lahomi Sosona, you don't care if we die. Lahaglo Sosona Bovel, to take us to Golas and Bovel. How do you like that for the crowning climax of Yirmiyahu's experiences with the people of Israel? First they say, whatever you say, you just tell us, Rabbi. We're no problem. And then they say, you're a liar, you're making it up, it's politics. You're not interested in us, you want to kill us. Poor Yirmiyahu. And so they left for Egypt. And here you see again the greatness of Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu went with them because he knew they needed him. And he knew he had to go. So Yirmiyahu and Baruch ben Neriah went into the Egyptian exile with them. Went together. The reasons that the rabbis advance why they should have stayed in Eretz Yisrael are, number one, that these Jews would have formed the nucleus for the second Beis HaMikdash. Jews were coming back in 52 years. These Jews, there would have been a Jewish community. The Jews, in the time of the Second Temple, never would have had the problems that they had later with the Shomronim and with the Goyim who took over Yerushalayim, etc., because of the fact that the Jews would have been there, the Shomronim wouldn't have been there. The Shomronim were able to claim they were the Jews because there were no Jews in the country, so to speak. So therefore, Yirmiyahu wanted them to stay for that reason. The second reason is Yirmiyahu knew that the Babylonians would not punish them. That Nebuchadnezzar was wise enough to realize that Yishmael was a dupe of the king of Bnei Amon, and that it was all the fault of Balis, and therefore they would not have had any terrible repercussions. Thirdly, he knew that the general policy of Bovel was not to leave such a valuable piece of land unoccupied, and that the Jews therefore had political and geographic necessity for Bovel. Fourthly, he told them that it's also for the Jews to go back to Egypt. It's a halacha, three times in the Torah it says you're not allowed to go back to Egypt. I've mentioned to you a number of times that according to tradition, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, who lived in Cairo, what is today Cairo, El Fayume, would sign his letters, Onochi Moshe ben Maimon Asfardi, I, Moses, the son of Maimon from Spain, Ho'over b'chol yom al shlosha lavin shabbat Torah, who every day transgresses over at least three commandments in the Torah because I'm living in Egypt. And the Novi didn't told them they shouldn't go. Nevertheless, when they decided to go, the Novi still went with them. So strong was his love, so strong was his loyalty, that he could not abandon them. Even in the worst of times, and the worst of Jews, and the most disrespectful of Jews, the things that they said to him, he nevertheless refused to be hurt personally, so to speak. We see a grandeur of spirit here that is almost unimaginable. And he went with them down into Egypt. The Jews came to Sahpanches, which many say is the city of Thebes on the Nile. And the Jews also came to Helios. And there, the Novi Yirmiyah prophesies again. This prophecy, usually there are no prophecies in exile. I discussed this when we learned together about the Novi Yecheskel. But since he already was a legitimate prophet from the land of Israel, this is not his beginning prophecy, so the spirit of prophecy extended over him even when he was in Mitzrayim. And God said to them, take four large stones, boulders, and put them down in the middle of the street, across the street from the palace of the Pharaoh. And the Jewish people will say, what are you, crazy? He said, the old man schlepping stones, what are you doing? And he said to them, these are the foundations for the throne of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, who is coming here. And he's going to put his throne on these four stones. You ran to escape from him. You got him right here. Now that made a marked impression upon them, as you can well imagine. And there he said the famous phrase, Asher Lamoves, Lamoves. Asher Lashvi, Lashvi, Asher Lacherev, Lechorev. Those that die will die. Those that will be captured will be captured. Those that will be killed will be killed. There is no escape here. And all of Egyptian society will be destroyed. And this strong message also was meant to warn them not to assimilate into Egyptian society. The rabbis always held Egyptian society, out of all of the societies, was the worst, because it was the most corrupt, it was the most sexually immoral, it was the society of the depths of paganism, even though it had flashes of belief that were close to monotheism in its long history, but it always sank back into it, and it was the land of the dead. It worshipped the dead, and it was the land of death. And the rabbis had the phrase that it was called the land of death. And therefore he said, under no circumstances shall you assimilate into their society. It's interesting that in Babel the Jews did not really assimilate much into the Babylonian society, because they did not have too appealing a society, too appealing a religion. But Mitzrayim, with all of its grandeur, right? You go to the British Museum and you see their Egyptology room that they stole from the Egyptians and brought it to England. And you see what it looks like and you're impressed by it and everything else. You realize the attraction that it had, the obelisks, the art forms, the mummies, the whole thing. And therefore, Yirmiyah was justifiably bothered by the fact that they could assimilate very easily. So he said, you know, like he said, don't make yourself too comfortable, because this guy's coming here. He's going next, you know, his next visit is to Mitzrayim. Don't think that Mitzrayim will be able to ride out the storm. but that the Babylonian Empire definitely is coming to Egypt and it will destroy Egypt. And those of you who are here will unfortunately share in the destruction. Nevertheless, this became the basis of the great Egyptian Jewish community, which in later years in Alexandria especially was one of the largest and wealthiest Jewish communities in the world. And the Jews were in Egypt from that time till our time, in an unbroken line. And Yirmiyahu himself, according to most tradition, died in Egypt. While there's his Talmud, Baruch ben Neriah, eventually left Egypt and came to the exile in Bovel. And there in the exile in Bovel, he was the mentor of Ezra Sofer, who would return and rebuild the Second Temple and revitalize Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael. So we have here this sad story of how Machlokas and jealousy and divisiveness and terror and violence all played such a strong role here, even in the shadow of the Churban. 2 months after the Churban, all of this happened. So the story of Gedaliah and the story of Yirmiyahu going to Egypt is really the nail in the coffin. And that sealed, more than anything else, the doom of the Jewish people as far as the First Temple was concerned. Eretz Yisrael is now empty of Jews. You have in Eretz Yisrael the Shomronim, the Samaritans, who will pretend to be Jews and who will be a tremendous thorn in the...